It's Halsey with the Helicopter Podcast, and I hope you're enjoying listening to the podcast. But just to make sure that you are aware, if you would also like to watch the podcast, you can go to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast YouTube channel. We post all of our podcasts to video format there. We're also doing a lot of really cool things over there, like vlogs. We did a bunch of fun stuff at HAI, including in-person interviews with all these amazing people. So do me a favor, head over to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast. Hope you enjoy.
This podcast is brought to you by Cellacopter. Tired of listings that go nowhere? Exhausted by tire kickers who waste your time? Don't sell your helicopter alone. Cellacopter handles the entire process from start to finish. So if your helicopter is sat too long waiting for a buyer, contact the team at Cellacopter today for your complimentary market valuation. Call 1-855-CELICOPTER, 1-855-735-5226, or email sales@cellacopter.com. Cellacopter. List it, sell it, done.
Hello and welcome to the Helicopter Podcast. My name is Halsey Scheider, and this is episode 5 with Trent Vick. Trent, what's happening, man? Can you see me and hear me okay?
I can. How's it going?
It's going good, man. I was just thinking to myself before we clicked record here that you are my first guest that I don't actually know all that well. I was kind of patting myself on the first few, you know, to kind of give myself a little extra getting used to this whole podcast thing. And I knew those previous guests, but this is kind of our first time meeting. So I'm really excited to have you on the show. I know that we have some mutual contacts and I'm really excited to hear about what you're doing. And I hope that we can talk about that picture that you just posted on Facebook the other night. it looks like maybe some heli skiing or something. Anyway, I'm super excited to dive into it. Why don't you introduce yourself to our audience?
Hey, I'm Trent Vick. I currently work for Precision Helicopters as a, I just call it a line pilot. Doing a mixed bag of things. We're doing primarily probably a lot of firefighting in the summer, and then I've done kind of some odd jobs for them. I'm doing drill support and then Christmas trees and just starting doing some heli ski training. So very wet behind the ears with heli ski. Still definitely not the expert on that, but looking forward to getting better at that, hopefully.
Man, that has to be like a dream job if you can do that. Like, that would be incredible.
Man, it's everything you're hoping for when you're in flight school, it seems like I'm kind of getting the chance to do. So it's really awesome.
That's awesome. I'm a really avid skier. So I feel like I would have a hard time because I'd be like, oh, this is really fun flying, but that line looks sweet. Like, can someone else fly and I'll go ski? But I think both would be awesome. So, hey, welcome to the show, Trent. We're excited to have you. I noticed prior to us kind of talking and actually you brought it to my attention that I haven't done a great job at kind of introducing myself. So I'm also just real quick for the masses going to give my quick introduction. Again, episode 5. I am surprisingly enough, I am a helicopter pilot. So I do constitute to host this show. Like Trent and many of the guests that I've had on already, I started at Hillsborough Aviation. I think it's now Hillsborough Aero Academy. Did the whole flight instructor thing there. Moved to Texas, did some cool kind of R-44, hog hunting, survey work, things like that. Then ended up at the Canyon flying Maverick, and that was cool. I got essentially all my turbine time at that point. At that same time, about 3.5-4 years ago, I started an aircraft brokerage called Aircraft Brokerage of Texas at that time, and was just selling helicopters kind of for fun on the side. The transition into an air medical position, kept doing that brokerage job, and the brokerage just kind of grew and grew and grew. So I've actually been full time with my company. It's called Cellacopter now, and I still fly on the side. I fly for the news here in San Antonio as a backup pilot. So that's in a B3 Jet Ranger, that is. So for my guests out there, I haven't been great at my introduction. So Trent, thanks for reminding me prior to the podcast here. So that's me, but enough about me. So I want to talk a little bit about it. What's your background prior to flying, Trent?
Prior to flying, I grew up in Missouri, so I was doing lots of farm stuff, and it actually kind of leads in a little bit to why I chose kind of some of the steps I did. But my grandpa owned a fertilizing company, And so, you know, I kind of grew up on the farm with him doing ground rig spraying. So nothing with aircraft. And then basically high school came around and kind of got inspired to go fly and realized that, you know, I just wasn't in a position to get the loans and kind of get set up. So I went into the Air Force. Went to the Air Force for 4 years, was based in South Carolina. And then, you know, Hillsboro was always the goal. I found it before I left for the military and was like, oh, that's the place I'm going. And really fortunate, actually, that everything worked out with the VA. And I was able to go in under the post 9/11 and get probably 99% of my training paid for through Hillsboro. So.
Oh, that's lucky. I know that. I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast yet or one that's at least posted yet, but there have been some issues with the VA people abusing, essentially flight schools abusing, you know, flying the A-Star for the private through, you know, CFI and whatnot. So you were able to utilize the whole entire post 9/11?
Yep. Yeah, I think, you know, as long as you kind of stay within the confines of what they've scheduled on their, you know, their syllabuses in the 141 program, if you're not going over or taking your time, you know, dilly-dallying, you should be able to get it. Now, it's constantly evolving. So it's kind of like if you're, I mean, if you were just listening to this podcast trying to figure out how to do it, you know, you just going into the military, expecting them to pay for it whenever you get out in 4 years, you know, with Congress and everything, there's kind of no telling. But I know right now at Precision, our flight school site is still using that post 9/11 in conjunction with the college program. So you're getting your degree and your ratings at the same time. So.
And that's always kind of been the stipulation when it comes to the VA. If you're out there and you're listening and you do want to utilize your GI benefits, you can't just go to, like, say, a Part 61 school that's not associated or linked up with a college. For Hillsborough's case, they're linked up with Portland Community College. And so you would concurrently do – I don't think you don't get a four-year degree from it. You end up with, like, an associate's degree from the college, yeah, right?
You can. So there's – There's kind of two forms, and there's a Montgomery GI Bill, which I know you had Emily Spates on the other day. Sound like she used the Montgomery GI Bill. And so the Montgomery GI Bill, they don't cover your entire training. So right off the bat, you're going to be into it for private. So I actually started paying for my private out of pocket, thinking I was going to have to use the Montgomery. And then literally about after I got my first 10 hours, came down the line that, oh, they're actually going to let you do it under the post 9/11, which will do a fully funded thing as long as you go to the approved program. And so you kind of have to find the right place. You can get a 2-year degree typically if all you want is your ratings. And then I think there's other places like maybe Embry-Riddle or something like that, or maybe you could go to a 4-year degree. But in either case, your 2-year degree will line up really well with Embry-Riddle courses. You know, because they're doing aviation stuff. So if you really were like, hey, I really want to get that 4-year degree, you could go to Embry-Riddle and get that as well.
Yeah. And I mean, if you are new to helicopters and you're thinking about getting in as a profession, I'm just going to say it out loud right now. You don't necessarily need a 4-year degree or any degree, actually. I didn't go to college. Now, on the airplane side, with the majors, American Airlines, I don't know exactly which airlines, but essentially, they may require a 4-year degree, but that actually might be changing because of the shortage. But essentially for the GI Bill, like you said, you did have to go and collect. So you use the GI Bill, which is awesome. We appreciate your service. And honestly, I hope that our elected officials keep supporting our veterans, specifically when it comes to vocational training. Like I think like helicopter school or welding or whatever. I mean, I think those are awesome ways for our veterans to, you know, get reimbursed a little bit for your time and service. So I appreciate you doing that. And I really hope that schools don't abuse it to lose it. And I hope that our elected officials can keep it going. So you were at Hillsboro.
Hey,
you
on got that note too. You know, everybody's always a little bit hesitant, but since I'm a veteran, I feel like I can say it, but the veterans need to hold their end of the bargain up too. You know, if they're going to that school and they're getting all this training paid for, it's funded by the taxpayers. I mean, granted, you're more than welcome to it, but you guys gotta show up on time, you know, prove that you're worth it, and, you know, still do the time. So,
yeah, and honestly, it's a great point, whether it's VA or non-VA, especially like a school like Precision or like Hillsboro, they're larger schools. You hopefully want to work for them as your first job, or some do at least. your interview starts from day one, right? So the second you walk in there as a student, they're kind of like, who is this guy? And in fact, we're going to have Jarrett Friend on here in a couple of weeks, and he's part of Hillsborough, and he hired me back in the day. And I started line service when I was 18, total punk. Like, I'm surprised I ever got a job for those guys after. I mean, I was not my best showing, so I'll have to kind of dive deep with Jarrett on that. But, you know, you're right. I did see both veterans and non-veteran students kind of drag their feet, not get the best showing, some entitlement if it was being paid for as well. So I appreciate you saying that. I think people think about helicopter school and you're like, oh, I'm just going to go fly helicopters. But it's a true commitment. All the ground.
It really is, yeah.
On top of doing it concurrently with a college, I mean, it's a full-time job. And so I'm glad to hear that you treated it like that. Now, forgive me if I'm wrong and thinking of someone else. I don't think I am. You're like kind of a rock star in your training, right? Was it there? Did you win like some type of award during your training or something?
I wouldn't say I was a rock star. Actually, if I'm being completely honest, I struggled at flight school. And that was one of the things I was going to speak to, you know, everybody comes in, they're super nervous about their interviews and whatnot is, you know, how good you are isn't as good as I think, you know, how much you just show up and you're just like willing to put in the time and effort, you know, because it didn't come naturally to me, you know, like the flying itself, I was pretty good at, but the ground I struggled with a lot. But I got the award was, I got my commercial license, and this is kind of, it's kind of a funny story how everything came together, but I work for the people who basically got me on at HTS now. So David Rath, the CEO of Precision, and Ty Burlingham. I kind of knew both of them. And HTS was looking for a co-pilot, and they didn't have to have a ton of requirements met for the contract that they were on. So they asked me if I wanted to go work for HTS as soon as I got with my commercial. So I got my commercial certificate on like, I don't know, like July 5th, 2015. And then like July 10th, I was walking out to an S-61 to go fight fire. And
really?
It was kind of funny because, I was walking out to the bird, and it was supposed to be a contract where we didn't get a whole lot of flying time, you know, but it was still a great experience for me. And we were walking out, and just so happened it was a relief pilot that was coming in from a K-MAX job. And he's like, well, I'm glad you're here. You can help me start the aircraft. You know, he's a very old, salty utility pilot. And I'm like, man, I don't even have a hard copy of my certificate yet.
the ink hasn't dried yet.
No, yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's actually really cool though, because I mean, that's really atypical. I know a couple people that kind of went directly into some type of commercial SIC position, but that, I mean, that's kind of rare. You said that you had some existing relationships. How did you develop that as a student pilot?
You know, so my dad is a lineman. He works on power lines. And going to school at PCC, we had this careers course. And it was kind of funny at the beginning of the careers course. She's like, you know, a lot of people say this is the most important course they'll take throughout their whole training. And it turned out to be the case for me, because part of the requirement was I had to do a employee interview. So I had to find three people from three different companies and interview them. And so my dad worked for power line companies, and he was always working around the helicopters, which was, you know, kind of one of the reasons I wanted to get in. So he gave me my current chief pilot's phone number like 5 or 6 years ago. And I called him and was just like, hey, you know, how are power lines? You know, I had all this list of questions I had to ask him and stuff, and just kind of sparked the relationship. And so here we are today, still working together.
Wow. It's incredible. I mean, this industry is all about networking for sure. And picking up the phone sometimes and putting yourself out there. That's really cool that paid off. So you walk me through a little bit of this contract, this first contract. Again, what was the airframe?
It was a S-61.
S-61. So very small helicopter.
No.
I'm kidding.
I was like...
just a little bit bigger than the R-22 that you had probably done the majority of your training in. What was that like? I mean, talk about like fake it till you make it and kind of just, you know, grab the bull by the horns. Can you share your experience a little bit, especially in kind of in the beginning of that?
Yeah, I mean, I got there and really overwhelmed right off the bat. Like, just crawling on the helicopter was a big deal, you know, because there's certain places to get up to this tall rotor head and stuff. And then I did my best to kind of dig out the books, but with the S-61, you know, I am not an X-60. I have 11 hours total in the aircraft, so I'm not a 61, you know, pilot, I would say. But try to dig out the books, but there are so many, you know, I mean, the stack of books is like this tall for that thing right off the bat. So it was really overwhelming. I remember I'd never even been around a turbine engine, and, you know, Ben Moore was my command pilot for a majority of it. He was extremely experienced, had 18,000 hours, really humble, great teacher. And he really put me at ease. But I do remember like him trying to let me even start it. And I was like scared to push the button, you know, because I knew how much money was on the line after I pushed that button. It was intense. But
that's so funny. The guy's like, hey, start the helicopter. You're like, I don't even know how to like climb on top of it to check the rotor, like let alone fly it. But that only lasted 11 hours.
Yeah, I think I ended up being out there. So it was a really kind of one-off contract for fire, I would say. It was a DOD contract out in Yakima where they were you were just there because the Army was essentially doing weapons training out there, and they were worried that, you know, they would shoot a gun and it would start a fire. So
sure.
Only had one fire the whole time we were there. It was a grass fire.
Okay, and so what happened then after that experience? Did you continue to work for that company in a different capacity, or what was your next move?
So I just finished my commercial. You know, the goal was always to, you know, go through and be able to be a command pilot for me, right? And I always kept that in mind. It was a good relationship that I had just kind of established with HTS. You know, now I knew the chief pilot there. He knew he could call me if they had something come up. But basically it was, okay, I took that. It was probably 3 weeks, maybe 3 to 5 weeks, I would say. I don't know. It's been a while now. And I went back to Hillsborough. I finished my CFI. That was something I really wanted to get because I knew, you know, you need to get that 1,000 hours of PIC. That was kind of the goal. So I went back to Hillsborough, got my instructor certificate. And, you know, at the time, when you were there as well, it was just extremely competitive for getting hired as a CFI.
Sure.
And they really wanted to kind of like take their time and make sure that they were hiring the right people. And I think I was interviewing with like 15 or 20 people at least. And there was like three positions, you know. And so I didn't feel like my chance, you know, you know, if you're doing the odds there, it's like, well, you know, what really sets me apart? I don't really have a whole lot of extra experience. So I kind of tried to you know, create a backup plan, so to speak. And with my grandpa doing that spraying business, I had always kind of thought that, hey, maybe I would like to do ag as like my actual career choice because it looked like fun flying. And I, you know, a lot of people were talking about how it's a second option. And so I don't know if you know Kyle Blackburn, but
he was of course.
I went and flew with or I didn't fly very much. I was the ground mixer and loader for Kyle Blackburn kind of in right after I finished my CFI. I did a summer with them, and you know, it wasn't a lot of flying experience, but it was really great. Just being around something that's totally different from flight school, you know, different type of flying for sure. And then, you know, you're learning about the operations side of things and whatnot. But
yeah, so what did that? I think it's pretty pretty typical, specifically in the ag world, that you are going to go and drive the truck for a little bit. You're going to load the chemical. You're going to learn the operation from the ground up, essentially. And yep. I think it's awesome you did it with Kyle Blackburn. I mean, oh my gosh, I've known Kyle for years and years and years and years. I'm not going to tangent on Kyle because no one cares that I know him. But is he still flying?
I think he took a little break from flying. I think he might be actually, you know, last time I talked to him was probably last summer. I think he was coming back to actually work on his instrument.
Oh, interesting. Well, if you happen to touch base with him, you have to tell him I say hi. So you didn't get to do a ton of ag flying. Was he in a Hiller or a 47?
Yep, a Hiller, 12E.
Oh, cool.
Yep. Which that's an interesting aircraft. You know, it's got so much history, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's super cool. I think there's another company in Oregon, Newberg, right, that operates Hiller and 47s, right? Western?
Yeah. Western is doing it, and I think they actually might be moving into Jet Rangers as well.
Interesting. Yeah. I know that they do a lot of forestry spraying.
I don't think there's a lot of maintenance for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a little bit of the crutch of that helicopter. So you did the summer there, you kind of cut your teeth a little bit, got a little bit of flying. What'd you do next?
So HTS called me up. It was in the Northwest, and with that particular company, the season isn't super long. It's like 3 months, you know, with some light kind of shoulder work on either end of that. And sorry, excuse me. As their season was,
don't die me.
As the season was winding down with them, Mike Gilpin at HTS called me back and asked me if I wanted to go fly the crane with them again. And I was like, yeah, that would be fun. And so went back, flew the crane for them. And that was a lot different contract, right? Because this time we were on a CWN contract, which I know you kind of talked about with Yo-Yo last time.
Yeah.
And we were hopping all over. I think, from Oregon, we went down to Ashland, Oregon, which is right on the border of California. And it was they call it a prepo, where you're pre-positioning. And that one was just kind of on the company. They said, hey, it sounds like there's quite a few fires in California. Let's get kind of close to there because we got a good chance of getting called up. And we did. We got called up and we went to Montana. So,
yeah, fly south and then go the opposite way.
Yeah, just kind of standard. But, yeah, flew all over the place. And then that's where you were talking about that kind of award thing. We ended up flying on a fire in Thompson Falls, and it was – it was kind of a cool experience that for me as a pilot, but you know, the community was just, you know, very kind of upset with the way the fire management had been handled, I think. And anyway, long story short, the fire was very small and almost out. And then a wind event came through and it went to 17,000 acres overnight. And it was just, you know, it was just this crazy fire. And, we were dipping in a river near some houses, and there was this kid that kept coming out and waving at us. And so we were kind of watching him as we were flying away. And apparently the story is, you know, he would like run from one side of the house to the other to watch us drop and then come back. And, you know, he's well away from the fire. There was no danger of that. But anyway, at the end of the day, we kind of did like a turn and like faced him, kind of waved the tail of the aircraft, you know, at this kid. And his grandma was out there snapping a bunch of pictures, and she put that on Facebook, and it went viral. Like, well, I mean, viral as in like got like 5,000 shares, you know, or something. Wow. Like that. And so
that's cool.
Yeah, it was kind of cool, and you know, I guess the kind of the reasoning behind it, I guess HAI being kind of excited about it was just that it was a good deal with the helicopter. And then, you know, at the end we drove out there to where he was at. We marked his location on the GPS and gave him hats and stickers and stuff and said hi.
Oh, cool. I mean, so, honestly, that's super cool. Important. I, you know, flying can be a little bit mundane sometimes, specifically a lot of the flying I've done. I mean, when you're flying fire and stuff, I mean, I would just imagine it's just the most fun you can have with clothes on, essentially. But, you know, doing the EMS, things, canyon, whatever, like kind of straight and level, it has its challenges, but I mean, it comes with its like kind of mundaneness. And every time I saw a kid, like, you know, I'll be landing on a helicopter pad or a hospital pad somewhere, and there's like a little kid, and I'm like just bummed that I got, you know, called late shift or whatever, and there's this little kid. It's like, it kind of, it's a firm reminder of how cool helicopters are. I mean, like, if every little kid, boy or girl, universally thinks what you do is cool from an outside perspective, then like flying a helicopter is just the best. And I always try to kind of remind myself. And honestly, like, that kid's probably going to be a helicopter pilot now. Like, that little, you waved your tail to the sky crane. You went and gave him some swag. I mean, that kid probably still talks about it and is, you know, parents are trying to probably figure out now how they're going to pay for flight school. You probably really affected them financially negative. So that's cool. So you really, it sounds like on that contract, you built up a lot more experience. Yep. And now, did you continue to fly with HTS then after, or what happens next? I'm like following your story here. I'm loving it. It's fun to interview someone that I don't actually know their story. So I feel like,
well, mine's
dude,
so
where's
weird.
My car? And then
yeah, well, you know, I hopped around quite a bit at first, and there was a point where it was like, man, I think I might have jumped the gun a couple times. I'm moving too quick or whatever. But I tell like people who I'm talking to, because I get a lot of my former students call me, you know, like, hey, where should I go next and stuff. And I tell them, you know, maybe if I had it to do over again, I would have done some things differently. But it kind of got me to where I'm at anyway. So I wouldn't be where I'm at today if I hadn't done some of those things. But yeah, so kind of like from there, kind of go a little bit quicker. That was a really hard part, actually. After that season, I was like, oh, man, I'm the real deal. I'm flying this sky crane, you know, like I think I'm all cool and stuff. And it's like, well, wait a minute. If I just continue doing this, I've got like 200-300 hours now, and most of it's co-pilot time. You know, I'm not going to be super employable. And so I was like, well, time to go fly the 22. And I went back. Chris Horton was my chief pilot. I was like, hey, you know, I think it's time to start, you know, instructing. And I went back to Hillsboro, and I'm so glad I did. It was such a good experience, you know, to go back and actually instruct. I felt like, I mean, as you've talked about, and as you know, it was just, you know, you really learn how to fly the aircraft and really learn your trade well. So, and after that,
Oh, no, you're good. I would echo that. I mean, I would think that what's really cool about you is that you really, I mean, talk about a foundation that you built. You know, you learned a little bit of ag. You learned a little bit about that first contract, and then a lot of it on that second contract doing the sky crane. I mean, and then going back to CFI, I mean, I feel like it doesn't really get like a better, stronger foundation. It's certainly a weird way. Like here's, you know, A to B is faster in a straight line. So you kind of zigzagged, but I really think that you built a firm foundation. And I would imagine the other CFIs probably thought you were like the cool guy for having all like, oh yeah, I got the sky crane time. It's, Were people allowed to talk to you at Hillsboro?
Yeah, I think they quickly learned that I was just one of them, still just kind of like, you know, head just like right here above water, just to learn how to teach people how to fly.
Now, since you and I are pretty far apart in our helicopter experiences and training, specifically at Hillsboro, I'm just going to ask, what's your favorite helicopter there at Hillsboro? I want to see if it's still...
My favorite one was the one nobody wanted to fly and that I could get on the schedule. That was the one I flew.
Yeah.
I think 5-6 Tango was like, you couldn't even load it up, but it was like, it had like a weight restriction below what an R-22 normally was. So you could take like 10 gallons of fuel, but hey, it was always available. Nobody wanted to fly.
Oh man. Like,
off we go.
5-6 Tango was a rocket ship back in my time, man. Maybe had a bad overhaul or something. I love that helicopter.
I think it might have got dinged up at one point. And
I think it did, yeah. I think a little damage.
48 Alpha was also a good one because it was light and you could take the big boys.
Yep, 7148 Alpha, right? So that was later in my Hillsboro career. But yeah, man, I don't know why, man. I love talking about, like, I totally, like, live in the past. I still talk about playing football in high school. I mean, I love the past, you know? And it's, the helicopter training is no different. So you
what about Tango, man? That thing's a legend.
819er?
Yeah.
Well, here's a funny story. I'll tangent on myself here for a second, but I was in a funny position. So when I got hired as a CFI, it wasn't quite required that you needed your instrument at that point. And I had kind of lollygagged and not been super efficient. And I took out a loan, had a student loan, and I was dwindling on money. And it was kind of like, get my instrument and double I or get my CFI. And it was like, well, I'm clearly going to get my CFI. And I was lucky enough to still get hired. But the contingency was like, you're going to get hired and you got to get your instrument within like 3 months. And 2 years later, I got my instrument. And
standard.
So I didn't do a ton of flying in 603 Hotel or 819 Tango. I think I ended up getting in a position where Hillsboro was so tired of me talking about my instrument. I think they ended up saying, like, as a bonus 1 year, like, go in the 44, get your instrument knocked out. And so I got to do that, actually. So thank you, Hillsboro, for that. You know, I think I did maybe one or two training flights, including my check ride in Tango. So pretty, I don't have a ton of time, but I just remember that helicopter being like impossible to schedule and everyone always freaking out and it going back and forth. But, I could reminisce all day. But it's all about, Trent Vick today. And I'm really enjoying the story here and kind of your path. I mean, it's really cool to hear. I love hearing, non-standard. You know, so much of, especially if you come from a big flight school, so many of my contacts just kind of take a standard path. You go to flight school, you become an instructor, you go fly Grand Canyon tours, which you did, by the way, right? When did that happen?
That happened right after flight school. Yep. Got hired by Sundance.
Okay. Okay, cool. And how long were you there?
I'll say not as long as most. How do I say this? I had the exposure to the utility world, and I was flying around with these pilots that I just held in such high regard. And then whenever I went into the canyon, it wasn't anything with the company or anything like that. It just, I felt like in my personal life and everything considered, it just wasn't the best fit for me, you know. And I'm sure there's lots of pilots that are like, well, yeah, you know, it's tours in the canyon, you know, suck it up, buttercup. But just so kind of worked out where it was like, hey, I have these kind of like other options because of, like you said, the foundations that I had made. And I went there for probably 4 months or so, maybe 5 months. And I got probably, I think, 250 hours of A-Star time. And I was already in talks with Precision. I'd been keeping in touch with my chief pilot, current chief pilot now, and kind of knew that was going to be an option. And so I ended up actually taking another job with HTS for one final season there towards the middle of summer there. And did another little stint on fires with the Sky Crane. And then that's where I got picked up with Precision. So
okay, cool. And for our listeners out there, I mean, I'm very familiar with Precision, and man, they've grown very big since I first heard about them back in the day. You know, I think when I first heard about them, they had maybe one or two Schweitzers that were flying to flight school there in Newburg.
Yep.
And now on the flight school side, they're really big in the G2, correct?
Yep.
There, and I think honestly the only dealer or service center for the G2,
as far as
it was, one of the first,
definitely the first in the US, and I think the only distributor, at least on the West Coast. You know, I'm not as into the flight school side as I was a couple years ago there. I think there might be an East Coast supplier, but generally speaking, if there's a Cabri in the United States, it's going through Precision
at one point. Yeah, it's crazy. Now, yep. Do you have time in the Cabri?
Yeah, I got about 200 hours in it.
I got a tangent on it because I don't have any experience. And I sold one recently.
Oh, really?
One that actually was owned by Precision at some point, of course. This one, the one that I sold actually had been in a rollover accident, dynamic rollover down in California, got shipped back up to Precision, got completely rebuilt through Precision.
Is that I'm trying to think.
And my...
Oh, you cut out there. Sorry. What was the tail number on it? Do you remember?
I honestly don't remember. And I think in my agreements, I usually have some type of confidentiality type deal. So, But so we'll forego the end number. But yeah, Precision touched it. They like rebuilt it. And I'm very curious about that aircraft. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I feel like I'm kind of like in this kind of like unique position because there's the Cabri guys and then there's the Robinson guys. And of course, you know, there's this big, maybe not a big rivalry, you know, but like between pilots, you know, like there's always that rivalry. So some interesting things about the Cabri. One, it's a Finistron, which is kind of nice for, you know, I kind of found that after I was flying that Finistron around because I had, you know, like 15 hours on a 130. It's very similar to flying a 130. It does take a little bit of getting used to from the pilot's perspective, but it's nice because it kind of adds that one, it's a lot quieter. So we're flying in a small little kind of area where we're not wanting to bug a bunch of people. It's really quiet when it flies. It's also, like if you're doing some tight off airports, there's just kind of that like little, like you feel like it's a little bit safer back there maybe, and maybe it's not a justified thing, but it's shrouded. So, you know, you're not going to hit branches with it or something on the tips or something as you're coming in. So,
sure.
I always kind of like that about it. As far as instructing it, I can tell you one of the major things that I talk about is, well, two really. One is just as far as taking the controls from students. In the Robinson, I felt like I was guarding it a lot more because, as you know, lower inertia rotor system, those rotor RPM are just going up and down super quick. And overspeeds are really, really easy to get in a 22. And yeah, yeah,
that's karate the chop.
Yeah, in the Cabri, it's got a really high inertia rotor system, and you almost can't overspeed the rotor system in that. I mean, you would almost have to be trying to overspeed it.
Interesting.
Because it just kind of naturally gets to a point where, hey, this is as high as I'm going to go. And unless you're really like, you know, big flare collective all the way down from a high speed or something, it's not going to want to overspeed. So that was kind of nice. The other thing is the even more importantly, right, is the low RPM, right? And it just kind of hangs out there. It is a little bit more difficult, as you know, if you've flown the difference between high inertia rotor and low inertia, right? The higher inertia is harder to get back your rotor RPMs, but it's also harder to lose it. And so it was, I just noticed as from the instructor standpoint, I just had to do, it's such a reduced amount of workload in the Cabri as far as that inertia rotor system goes. The other thing is with soloing students, it's got auto carb heat. And that to me was huge. And, you know, whenever I came out of the Robinson, I was like, auto carb heat, I'm not going to trust that, you know, because we hear so much about the carb heat accidents and stuff, but
yeah, of course.
But the auto carb heat, man, it just works really well. I, you know, it's like anything, you got to monitor it, right? You don't want to just put full faith in that little computer that tells you it needs it or doesn't, but it's so nice for that student that's got 20 or 30 hours and already has their hands full with navigating and just being nervous about soloing, you know, it's one more thing they don't have to forget. And there was actually an accident of one of the students that I had flown with a little bit in a Robinson, and I have a suspicion that it was carb ice. And so that was always kind of just like gave you the warm and fuzzies, you know, knowing that that auto carb heat is there. And then, man, I don't know. Being that, you know, having flown both, if I had to pick one that I was going to send a family member to, I would probably pick the Cabri.
Interesting.
I think a fair
assessment. I mean, especially, I mean, you have a ton of time in a Robinson and you have a ton of time. I think that's the problem in the industry though, is like, you would still go and fly the Robinson. For me, when it comes to this whole kind of Robbie like sucks or whatever, it's, I get it. Like the 22 has some certain limitations, underslung, low inertia. But I also have so much experience in that airframe, and I felt like, man, if you just operate it within its limits, within your limits as a pilot, you don't push the envelope and you respect it, then at the end of the day, most of the time the aircraft's going to be pretty friendly to you. Yep. But if there's a better option out there, like certainly, like do I necessarily love to go fly the R-22? No, you know, you start flying something that you prefer a little bit better, whether it's a comparable like the Cabri or you get into a turbine or whatnot. You know, I think it's okay to say like, hey, listen, the 22 is great for what it was for and I love training in it, but hey, this aircraft presents a little bit better and I enjoy flying it, you know, a little bit better. It seems like you can't be, you know, just like real politics is you can't be in the middle of anything, right? Either hate Robbies or you love them, you know, can't figure out where my hands are. And so it's like, it's kind of good to hear, like, you know, it's you have a good perspective. And, you know, I would love to fly the Cabri. It looks cool. The whole panel looks, you know, kind of updated and fancy with the glass cockpit and things like that. So now at Precision, you said that you've done some Christmas tree flying. Is that something you do yearly?
Yep. It is now. Man, yeah.
That is production work, huh? I mean, are they like sitting on the ground with a timer? Because those, I've seen like that, I think there's that famous YouTube video of the guy in Oregon. Oh, yeah. You know, that guy was, are you that good?
I haven't been fired yet.
Perfect. That's perfect. And what airframe are you all doing that Christmas trees in?
You know, so Precision, they've got a pretty long history with it. Tyler Sturdivant, he's been doing them. I think he started in the 500. I want to say that he has like 11 years and he's been with Precision since the beginning. So I know they've got a pretty long kind of rich history with this Christmas tree stuff. 500s is what they were using. And I've got no time in a 500, unfortunately, but I think they were running into maintenance issues because it's such repetitive lift and they were kind of timing components out. And so we're using 206s, and typically you'll see guys use the Jet Rangers just because operating costs are lower, use a little bit less fuel. And we ended up using both the seasons I've done it now. I've done it 2 years. Was a Long Ranger L3.
Interesting. And is that pretty challenging? I mean, it seems from the outside perspective to be kind of a stressful operation.
Is it challenging? Yes. Stressful? I would say, you know, I love Christmas trees. I am like a fanboy of Christmas trees, and I think I'm one of the few guys who have done it who say that. You know, it seems like all these guys, and maybe it's because I'm still kind of young to utility, I feel like, and long lining, but, you know, you show up to work and you pre-flight the aircraft, you know, take care of all that, but it's you fire the aircraft up and you fly until you can't walk, and then you get out and then you go home, sleep for 8 hours, do it again the next day for 30 days in a row, you know.
It's a month long.
Yeah, it's usually so November is the harvest season, and then there's kind of like a shoulder on either end of the month of November, it seems like, where they might have a couple extra you need to do. But yeah, I mean, it can be stressful. I definitely, my first season, you know, I was riding that struggle bus quite a bit, because it's that fine line you're walking where you're trying to keep the customer happy by, you know, producing enough Christmas trees for them, and then also not killing yourself. So
certainly
there's a fine balance there, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know if this is true or not, so if I'm making this up, I apologize, but I'm going to throw it out there. I think that video that I was referring to, I think that guy ended up balling it up after. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think there was talk that helicopter ended up in an accident shortly after that video.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. That's a rumor I heard too. Cannot confirm.
Yeah, and that's good. If you're listening, first off, thank you. And second off, that is a rumor, but potentially true. So, well, that's really cool. So that kind of brings us up to speed of where you're at today. What's your total time at now?
About 2,600 hours.
2,600 hours, and you started in 14, correct?
Yep.
And what is kind of now your trajectory? I mean, you're still with Precision. What's on tap next? What are you flying next?
You know, it's kind of funny. Actually, one of the guys I was flying with was asking me that question like last year, and I was flying with him down to, I don't remember where we were flying, but we were on some kind of a cross country, and I was like, I think I'm kind of doing it. Like, I'm just hanging out at Precision. The newest thing on my plate with Precision is sounds like this heli ski stuff. So I just got back from Silverton, Colorado, doing right seat flying in a 205 with my chief pilot, doing some heli ski stuff. And I'm supposed to be slated to go to Alaska here in a couple days to actually kind of work in conjunction with Pathfinder and fly the A-Star and kind of maybe turn out as a heli ski pilot. We'll see if I'm any good at it or not.
Really? That would be amazing. So you just had your first experience this past week then?
Yeah, you know, I backseated and kind of, because I was, you know, as I was coming up in the company, they would let me ferry the aircraft out to the heli ski jobs, and then I'd like ride backseat as much as I could. And so I've been, you know, kind of exposed to it a little bit, talking with other pilots. But that was my first time, like, you know, actually going out and doing some of these deep snow landings and high altitude stuff. So
yeah, I mean, so beyond the altitude and I guess the lack of performance because of altitude, I mean, there's so many factors working against you. I mean, wind, performance, landing area. What are you finding to be kind of the biggest learning curve right now in that operation?
Well, you know, this time it was different as well. So it's a different mission profile that I've ever done. And then also being in that 205, the biggest thing with heli ski is it's, you know, these operators are working on kind of tight margins. And so efficiency is kind of key. So you want to get up and down as fast as you can without burning a bunch of flight time on empty legs, you know. So that was just, you know, kind of learning the pace that you're flying at was kind of part of it. Definitely the snow landings are, they can be interesting. You know, you're coming in and it's whiteout conditions, and we were flying and, you know, we were sitting up there on top of this mountain at like just under 12,000, I think, and everybody was unloading. And the winds were so strong that it felt like as the passengers got out, you know, the 205, that's eight people, the helicopter wanted to start flying because it was already an ETL. The collective's kind of bottomed out and the helicopter's wanting to start moving already.
Oh, God.
So windy.
Oh, God. You're so, like, yeah. Don't do that. Stop that right now. Yeah.
I'm sure all the seasoned heli-ski pilots were like, oh, yeah, that's just...
Yeah, that's just, old hat, that's just how it is. I mean, that's just... I mean, the whole profile, it seems amazing. It would be gorgeous, obviously, but it's intimidating. I flew some tours at Mount St. Helens, whoop-dee, but just flying around a big mountain is somewhat intimidating. I don't, or at least for me, it was like, man, this is just such a giant, giant thing. And it almost has its own little climate with weather, wind, you know? So I think that I would say that, a heli ski pilot are probably some of the most, you know, technical, it's one that has to be one of the most technical jobs in our industry.
It's a lot of takeoffs and landings, right? And you're kind of in that area as well where you're, you know, more takeoffs and landings you do, I guess, you're kind of increasing that exposure. I kind of got lucky because I did a drill job in Montana where we were doing drill support for the last 2 years. I've done that.
What
and
is
it's
that?
Up at 10-5 and it. So basically these guys, they're drilling for core samples in this particular job, you know, could be something different. They're looking for platinum palladium products and stuff. And my job is essentially support. So it's similar to the Gulf of Mexico kind of job, you know, where you're flying the crew in the morning. Difference being I'm long lining stuff up to them. So I have to, they need everything by helicopter because it's a 6 hour drive or a 20 minute flight. And so that was at 10,000 feet as well in the L4, which was a handful. And, so I kind of got that exposure to the mountain flying there in August. It's like, we had like 3 feet of snow in August. So I kind of got like a little mini exposure to like heli ski before I'm actually doing it. But yeah,
it's
I know
funny
what
how
you're
that
talking
works
about.
Sometimes was, like that.
Yeah. It was, definitely the same feeling as you. Whenever I first got there, I had very minimal time in the 206, very kind of, you know, just cutting my teeth on any long lining stuff. And, yeah, those mountains are intimidating, man, for sure.
Yeah, no, it's intense. Super cool, but yeah, always kind of gave me a little bit of the heebie-jeebies, I suppose. It's the best way I could put it. Now, that's probably a stark difference, too. Like, if you can fly an L4 at 10.5 or an L3, then the Huey's has to be a little bit easier on the power side of things, right?
Well, it's...
Well, I guess you load it with eight people.
It's just one of those things. Like I tell my students, it's like every time you have a helicopter, typically you're going to, you know,
if max gross. Eight people.
Yeah. Yep. I, the 206 and the 205 handled so similarly to me. It felt like just everything was just kind of bigger in the 205, you know, bigger movements and leading and being ahead of the aircraft. There's that much more, but.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see that. And that's another thing against, you know, with Robinson's people, oh, it's so power limited. But it's like every helicopter I've ever flown is power limited because if you're flying for money, yep, people load it up, you know. So that's, you know, it's a good reminder. So you're coming into this new adventure. You're working at Precision. You're obviously really enjoying it. Are you living in Oregon then?
Yeah, well, I am currently. I'm living in Oregon, and we actually just bought a house in Montana, so I'm going to continue working with Precision. I actually had to hang up this picture because I wanted a cool background, you know? But we've got everything in our house is blank, but I was like, well, I got to have something cool, you know? Like, Yo-Yo had a K-Max, so I was like...
I know. Yeah, Yo-Yo had the ultimate interview. That was so fun. I haven't talked to Yo-Yo for like 12 years. And that dude, I mean, God, talk about hitting the gas pedal. You know, he went from... You know, him and I having no hours, now he's at like 10,000 hours. I'm crazy. Like,
yeah,
that dude is just he's a machine. So, but it sounds like
It's funny. I actually met Yo-Yo whenever I was doing like a stint with Timberline I did like a week of fill-in, a co-pilot in the Blackhawk. I don't think he probably wouldn't remember me if he saw me, but it was funny that you did a podcast with him. Cause I was like, oh, I've been, I kind of like looked for him. Cause I'm like that, you know, he kind of, like he flew in the 205 and got this long hair like you were talking about. I'm like, he's a guy you would remember, right? But
he's kind of like Spicoli almost from like from Dazed and Confused. But is it Dazed and Confused? Why am I blanking right now? Spicoli, Dazed and Confused? I'm thinking it's either that or Fast. I think it's Fast Times. I don't know. I probably just lost like 5 listeners for getting that wrong.
Oh, man. You're in trouble.
Which is all my listeners, darn it. So, Yo-Yo, it's funny because when I was at school with Yo-Yo, we had like this Yo-Yo and a few other dudes that were like just like these hardcore base jumpers. You know, they would just do some crazy stuff. You know, hey, what'd you do over the weekend? I was like, oh, I mowed my parents' lawn. They're like, oh, we went and jumped off these towers. You know, like this, just insane guys. Including like this fighter pilot dude. It was all, but really fun. And Yo-Yo was great to have. But well, it seems like you're on your way, man. And it sounds like your path was different, but it's really led you to what seems to be a fulfilling career. And certainly you're kind of quintessential helicopter guy right now, you know, flying heli skiing, flying some fire, I'm sure still in the future, utility. Precision's only getting bigger. What is their fleet size now there at Precision?
You know, I want to say, let's see, we got 4 A-stars currently, a 205. And then we're actually building a Super Puma right now. So it's kind of interesting.
Really?
Like, I think the idea is, and, you know, I'm sure they could speak better to it because I'm just a line pilot, you know, so I'm kind of getting everything third party. But the idea is that it could be competitive with the Blackhawk, and it's not a restricted type aircraft. So you could actually theory haul passengers. So.
And is that the 225 LP?
332L, I believe.
I'm a little bit familiar with the Super Puma, and actually I want to talk about the Super Puma because this is the helicopter podcast, and that's a big helicopter with a weird past. And I've actually been able to kind of educate myself a little bit on the 225 lately, and it's an incredible machine. Now, for our listeners out there who are unfamiliar, they had some issues. I want to say 2 incidents, one in Norway, and I don't know where the other one was, but essentially a catastrophic failure within the planetary gear of the gearbox, causing mass, a separation, the rotor separating from the helicopter. Obviously not a good day for the crew, and caused this big kind of grounding, fleet-wide grounding. I think they were like $28 million brand new. And once they got ungrounded, I don't know exactly what the prices are now, but not $28 million. But Airbus has done a great job at figuring out the root issue in that planetary gear, addressing it. And to my knowledge, a lot of companies now are using them and putting a ton of flight hours on them. And they're competing with the Blackhawk, competing with other utility aircraft, and at a fraction, you could get relatively brand new Super Puma for pretty cheap. So it's cool. I didn't realize that Precision was jumping on that game as well.
Yeah, I think they went with the 332, because I am not the guy to ask about the Super Pumas either. But it sounds like the 225s have the digital cockpits, essentially the glass cockpits?
You know, I don't know the differences enough to confidently say that. Now, I was just at a facility recently last week that operates a ton of 225s, and yes, the cockpits that I was experiencing there were all glass pretty sweet actually. I can't believe how big that helicopter is. Like when you're standing next to it, you're like, oh wow, I fully get the sense. And I had no idea that Precision was going that route. Maybe I did. I think maybe Brian mentioned something about it now that I'm thinking about it, but that's pretty neat. And
yeah, my chief pilot just got back. They sent him and another pilot out there to France to get trained because there's not actually a factory course here. So it's been kind of interesting hearing it like third party, they're trying to get contracts for it and whatnot. And, like Yo-Yo was talking about too, like there's also, all the support that comes with that, you got to get support trucks, support people, and people trained up. So it's going to be pretty interesting to see how that program kind of morphs into something bigger. And I kind of see Precision going, I've heard the CEO kind of talk about it, David Rath, maybe getting one or two of those, possibly a couple of mediums and then a couple of lights. It doesn't sound like he wants to be a, you know, this huge place, but kind of similar to the, he was, I think the president of the helicopter side of Evergreen whenever it was going. So yes. We've got like kind of some ties to Evergreen.
Of course.
And I kind of see it being similar.
I mean,
to that.
That's all in that area. I think David and I know each other. I think him and I met back in the day. I think I was living in Oregon still. I don't really quite remember it. I wasn't qualified, and they were at the time in the need for a 135 chief pilot.
Yeah.
And I went and talked to him, and I just, like, super nice guy. I knew we had mutual contacts. I knew some of the mechanics and whatnot that had worked there, but I just didn't have the experience required to, you know, to be a chief. And I've always kind of wondered, like, what would have happened, because if I would have had the experience and would have had the opportunity to work there, I think that I would have loved it. And it being in Oregon would have been, like, at that point for me, ideal, since I was from Oregon and loved living in Oregon. So I always kind of, it's funny how things work, because now I can't think of it happening how it's happened for me, you know, and being in Texas, and I don't want to leave Texas. I love Texas, and I love being
down
here.
Well, you were
ahead of
your times, man. It sounds like everybody's moving to Texas now.
You know what? That's kind of scary, actually. I hope that's not necessarily the case, but Texas is cool. It's a state where it's starting a business has been relatively simple. There's not a ton of regulatory body that's, you know, puts up a bunch of red tape. Taxes are a little bit easier down here. The people are great. The Southern hospitality is real. I'm down here in South Texas. I think maybe those North Texans a little bougier than us down here in South Texas, but I think everyone's on the same level. But I will say, out there, I'm still a true Portland Trail Blazers fan. I hate the Spurs. Do not like the Cowboys. I'm a Packers fan. I don't know why. I've never been to Wisconsin, but I love the Packers.
Oh,
but,
man, that was a tough loss.
I know.
That's all right. I'm a Chiefs fan, so it was even worse.
Ooh, yeah. You know, I saw that coming. I knew. I just – when Tampa Bay won and it was settled, it was going to be Tampa and KC, I just knew it. I knew that Tampa was going to win. I even – there was – I think with Andy Reid and his son being the coach and then having that, you know, accident a couple days before, I think that really threw off a lot of their mojo.
Yeah, I've been beat by Tom Brady so many times as a Chiefs fan. I was like, there's no way. I was just like,
he's the GOAT, man. Now, Missouri, it's funny. My helicopter career has taken me to Missouri several times, a place where I never thought I would be. Because, I worked for Air Evac Life Team, and they're based out of Missouri in O'Fallon. Yeah. And so I did all my recurrent training up there. And then doing the part-time Heli Inc. thing, they're based at the downtown St. Louis airport. And which I think is actually in Illinois, which is weird. Or maybe it's right across the bridge. I don't know. I'm terrible at geography. But so I've been to Missouri now probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. And I have to say, way more beautiful than I ever thought. I always just kind of thought it would be like this barren wasteland. I don't know why. But really, really pretty out there, especially O'Fallon. I've been there in the fall, flying over that, like all the trees. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, I grew up on the kind of the western side, just opposite there. I grew up in Kansas City area, so it's just hard. You know, all my family's been from Montana my whole life. I've just always had my eye on the mountains. So,
Montana,
it's hard to compare.
It's like the most beautiful state. Also,
it's
home
God's
of
country.
My
Actually,
favorite
it's
TV,
terrible
TV show.
Listening. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Montana sucks.
Don't go there.
Taxes are awful. The no speed limit thing is awful. Yeah, tons of COVID. Anyway, well, hey Trent, thank you so much for joining the Helicopter Podcast, man. I want to have you on here in like 6 months to a year after you get through a season of heli skiing. Try to mentally document it for us, because I really want to I think that's so cool. And in fact, if you have a chance, if you get any cool photos or video that you'd be willing to share, we'd love to share it on the Helicopter Podcast Facebook page. And speaking of which, if you are listening and you've enjoyed this, check us out on Facebook. It's the Helicopter Podcast. You can also listen to us on Spotify or iTunes, wherever you listen to podcasts. We also upload the video to YouTube on the Helicopter YouTube page. So really appreciate everyone listening. Appreciate my guests. I've been so fortunate to have people like Trent on. Trent, thank you so much. Any last words to impart on our listeners before we call it quits here?
No, I don't really think so. I mean, just hang in there. I know it's kind of tough for some of these guys right now, dealing with, you know, the industry's kind of in, it seems like in certain portions of the industry might be a little bit of a downturn. So, you know, hang in there,
a little bit of
keep
flux.
Flying, and it'll work out.
Yeah, and it will, and COVID has been tough. However, I have seen the industry, it seems to be relatively strong, and I think it depends on who you work for. I think if a lot of companies were maybe over-leveraged a little bit and, you know, had to keep paying those bank notes on assets, then that's COVID's been really tough.
Yeah.
I hope that we're kind of on the up and up, and I know a lot of people, specifically in the Canyon, have lost jobs, and EMS market's flooded now. So, you know, Air Evac used to have like, you know, 50 openings and now they have none. You know, it's all filled up. So I hope that things can get back to normal. And it's good to hear like companies like Precision, man, they're trucking along, flying contracts, doing all that fun stuff. I mean, it's good for my business, obviously. When helicopter people succeed, I succeed. So I really hope that it continues. And yeah, if you're out there, you're listening, you're having a hard time, man, just reach out to your network. It's all about playing the connection game. If you ask for help now, there's no harm in that. And essentially what I've always looked at in the helicopter world is it's only a matter of time to the person that you've asked help for is going to ask help from you or someone else. I mean, that's how I made it with helicopters, man. It was everyone was willing to kind of give me a chance or provide a helping hand. So if you're out there, you're struggling a little bit specifically because of COVID, man, just keep fighting and, you know, go hopefully land a job like Trent, man. Heliski, utility, Christmas trees. I love it all. So, hey, Trent, thanks so much again. This has been episode 5 of the Helicopter Podcast. Again, please like us on Facebook, share, troll us if you like. It doesn't matter. We love all the feedback, good and bad. So thank you again, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
As always, a special thanks to Celicopter for producing this podcast. Specializing in helicopter evaluations, faster sales, and superb service, Celicopter is the go-to agency for clients expecting immediate results. Celicopter's team of helicopter professionals are the best in the business. Using their aviation expertise, a nationwide network, and a proprietary 76-step listing strategy, Celicopter will convert your listing from mayday to payday. Ready to get started? Text HELICOPTER to 1-855-CELICOPTER. That's HELICOPTER to 1-855-735-5226. And a Celicopter pilot agent will reach out. Celicopter. List it, sell it, done.